Thank you. Good to see you all, and I hope you all had a good lunch and you're ready for another spirited set of sessions. We're going to start the second part of the day with a talk by a very special guest, and I'm delighted to welcome Her Excellency Ambassador Nirupama Rao to the Elliott School, to the George Washington University today. We're so honored, Ambassador Rao, that you graciously agreed to deliver the keynote address at this conference, because this is a very important conference for us, and it means a lot to have you participate in it. So thank you. Ambassador Rao's extensive bio is in your folder, but I would like to take a few moments to give a little background on her as well. Ambassador Rao was appointed India's ambassador to the U.S. only in September 2011, so I'm very pleased that we could get her over here toward the beginning of the term. That leaves her plenty of time to return when we'd like to have her back. As many of you know, the Seeger Center for Asian Studies, we have a India initiative that was launched a few years ago, and this is a major platform for India-related scholarship and outreach, particularly focusing on our students here. So I'm hoping there will be many opportunities for us to have the ambassador return. Now, Ambassador Rao is, I don't need to say this, but she's a seasoned diplomat, having served in key capitals during an exceptional career spanning more than 30 years. She held ambassadorial positions in Peru, Bolivia, Sri Lanka, and most recently China from 2006 to 2009, a very important 3 years. She then rose to the position of Foreign Secretary, which is the highest office in the Indian Foreign Service, for 2 years until her appointment as ambassador to the United States. She's not really a newcomer to the U.S. or Washington. She's has served as the Minister of Press and Cultural Affairs at the Indian Embassy here in the mid-1990s. And she also took some time away from the hectic policymaking world and retreated to the ivory towers of academia twice, first at Harvard University as a visiting fellow at the Center for International Affairs, and later closer to us at the University of Maryland as a distinguished international executive in residence. I also want to point out that Nirupama Rao is a trailblazer. In 2001, she was made the spokesperson for the Ministry of External Affairs, the first woman to hold this post. And when she became ambassador to China, that was the first for an Indian woman as well. And I must admit that being a woman of Indian origin myself, I feel it's a special privilege for me to be introducing her. Stellar performances have continued to place her at the most important capitals of the world. And finally, I would be remiss if I didn't reveal something about her other amazing talents that I happen to know of and perhaps you don't know. First of all, she's actually a poet. She has published a book of poetry. She holds an MA in English literature, and I can say that, you know, this is an accomplishment more than many practicing poets have been able to achieve, to publish a book of poetry, so kudos to the ambassador on that. She's also a trained singer in Western light and classical music, and I know she also plays the guitar whenever she has the free time, which I'm not sure where she finds the time to do all these things. But so it gives me just enormous pleasure to invite Ambassador Rao to the podium. And I also want to say the way we're going to do this is Ambassador Rao will be speaking for approximately 25 to 30 minutes, after which she has kindly agreed to spend a few minutes here and take a few questions, so I'll be back up to moderate that. So, Ambassador Rao. Dr. Deepa Olapalli, Richard Fontaine, distinguished ladies and gentlemen. I'm privileged to have this opportunity to address this conference on India as a global power, contending views from India, that the SIGUR Center is organizing as part of its efforts on exploring foreign policy debates of rising powers. The morning sessions would have given you a flavor of the various shades of opinion that exist in India on this subject. In my remarks, I would like to share my government's perspective, which might echo some of the views that you would have heard in the forenoon. This should not come as a surprise, for in India, there has generally existed a broad consensus on foreign policy, even though occasionally there might seem to be sharp differences. This was also recognized in the essay which Deepa co-authored as part of the GWU studies. That essay notes that outlining the various Indian perspectives on foreign policy is somewhat difficult because these perspectives fall within a fairly narrow range and that, I quote, the differences are not as great as might seem at first sight, unquote. What drives India's foreign policy? Like for all countries, our foreign policy seeks to forge strategies that serve India's interest, protects its sovereignty and its security concerns, and promote its economic development. Our vision of a secular, pluralistic, and tolerant society within the country, embracing diversity of opinions and outlook, is sought to be articulated in our dealings with the world. While we have paid attention to the strengthening of our military and strategic deterrent capabilities, we are not protagonists of the first use of force in settling outstanding issues, but rather, we have been advocates consistently of the use of diplomacy and statecraft in building relations and addressing problem issues. Of course, in the defense of our sovereignty and territorial integrity, we have shown our readiness and capacity to defend our interests militarily whenever the situation has demanded. India's global outlook and foreign policy is a reflection, therefore, of the priorities that it has defined for itself as it seeks to develop, to be secure, to withstand external threats, to ensure that its national and developmental interests are not diluted by actions by hostile players in the global arena. A key feature of our foreign policy has always been our desire to retain our ability to make independent decisions in the best interests of our people. I believe also that there is a strong sense of realism and pragmatism that informs Indian foreign policy in our new century and is attached to the principles that have guided us in external relations since the early years of our republic. Further, we live in a period of a transitioning world order, and where the continent of Asia is at the center of this fundamental change in economic balance, and where our success or otherwise in forging an inclusive architecture of economic integration and security cooperation for Asia will impact the destiny of a vast cross-section of the global population. Globalization is breaking barriers between countries and regions, and rising expectations in emergent economies, as well as new power rivalries, the compulsions of energy security, the unhindered growth and passage of trade between nations, the growing capability of non-state actors outside any rule-based system, the power and the grasp of new technologies and their capacity to change the way we have conventionally defined security and national defense, all these call for intelligent and creative responses in diplomacy in order to ensure secure and viable solutions. For the foreseeable future, our foremost national task is to ensure sustained economic growth so that we can provide opportunities to all of our citizens to realize their full potential. Our primary concern is to ensure a peaceful periphery and good relations with our neighbors. Our geography as a subcontinent must be transformed, as it has been said recently, into a geography of hope. With this, we also seek a balanced relationship with the major powers and a durable and equitable multilateral global order. India's stakes in a global and regional environment of peace, stability, and broader prosperity have never been higher. Today, as India's economic growth provides it with more weight and adds to our influence, we remain conscious that with this comes ever-increasing responsibility. Responsibility in weighing every move we make and positions we take with the realization that India is growingly one of the key players on the global stage today and will be called upon increasingly to deploy its potential in the interest of global peace and development. And buoyed by its sustainable economic growth, India is more willing and able to play a role commensurate with its size and destiny, whether in the UN Security Council or other multinational institutions such as G20. Let me take a few moments to illustrate these broad themes. How is India working to promote global peace and security? Let's start with our neighborhood. Developments in Afghanistan over the past few years have demonstrated that peace, security, and prosperity in today's world are indivisible. Both India and the US understand the imperative of ensuring success in Afghanistan. We have been engaged in developmental assistance efforts in Afghanistan at considerable human and economic cost. Our total assistance, totaling over $2 billion, has been guided by the priorities of the Afghan government and people. We are, in fact, supplementing our individual assistance efforts with joint projects with the United States, for instance, in areas such as in capacity building, agriculture, and women's empowerment in Afghanistan. We have also been fully supportive of US efforts to fight terrorism in Afghanistan and to bring stability there. In this regard, we are keenly watching recent efforts for a political dialogue. While we agree that ultimately there would have to be a political solution, we also believe that this should not become an overriding objective that needs to be achieved at all costs, for that would risk the prospect of a victory of those dark forces of terrorism and religious extremism that have plagued the region for so long. As was said recently, let us not wait for dusk and the owl of Minerva to spread its wings with awareness coming too late. Too much is at stake both for Afghanistan and for our region in what happens in that country. In the broader Indo-Pacific region, India is working with the United States as well as other countries of the region bilaterally and through forums such as ASEAN, the ASEAN Regional Forum, and the East Asia Summit to put in place an inclusive architecture that would allow all stakeholders to interact and cooperate to address traditional and non-traditional security challenges. One such challenge is maritime security. India has contributed its naval capabilities to help safeguard vital sea lanes in the region. In the past, we have cooperated with Indonesia, Singapore, and Malaysia to ensure security in the Malacca Straits. Today, we are cooperating with the US and with other naval forces in the Gulf of Aden and off the coast of Somalia to counter piracy. Terrorism continues to pose a threat to international peace and stability. India, having been a victim of terrorism for many decades, has worked with the international community to strengthen the international framework to deal with this threat. In the UN, for instance, we have taken the initiative to pilot the Comprehensive Convention on International Terrorism, or the CCIT, with the objective of providing a comprehensive legal framework to combat terrorism.
It is also clear that the threat from terrorism cannot be dealt with through national effort alone. While we have and will take appropriate domestic measures to strengthen our security, given the global nature of the threat, we are working with our international partners, including the US, to tackle the problem. The threat is compounded today given the possibility of intersection between terrorism and the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. We have been affected by clandestine nuclear proliferation in our neighborhood. Today, India is constructively engaged in international efforts to enhance nuclear security. In the long term, such threats can be met by universal and non-discriminatory disarmament, a cause that India has championed for many years. Climate change and the interlinked issue of energy security are increasingly going to affect our sustainable future and long-term prosperity. India's actions on this front reflect a balance of interests in ensuring our growth prospects and the development aspirations of our people and being a responsible global player. The global economic outlook continues to remain uncertain as the international financial and economic crises pose a challenge to a sustained recovery of the global economy. The Indian economy remains vulnerable to global economic turbulence. As a responsible member of the G20, India has tried to shape collective responses in meeting the challenges posed by the crisis and to send a message for building confidence and stability. Let me take a few moments to talk about our relations with the United States. Prime Minister Manmohan Singh said last year when he met President Obama during the East Asia Summit that, I quote, "There are today no irritants whatsoever in our working together on a multiplicity of areas, both bilateral and regional and global issues," unquote. Today, India and the US share a convergence of interests to ensure security for our people and stability in the world. If you just look at the progress we have made across a wide range of sectors in the last 2 years or so, it would be clear that our bilateral relationship with the United States is today better than it ever has been. The visits of Prime Minister Singh in 2009 and of President Obama in 2010, the launch of the strategic dialogue, whose third round will be held here in Washington in the summer of this year, has led to a qualitative change and expansion of our global strategic partnership. Our dialogue and cooperation on strategic issues and our bilateral cooperation in counterterrorism, information exchange, defense, have matured today and there is much enhanced mutual understanding. We have launched a new homeland security dialogue last year that is already imparting further momentum to our ongoing counterterrorism cooperation. We are trading both in goods and services much more than ever before. Investments are now flowing in both directions. Commercial links are strong and growing. Research-based partnerships are on the increase, and technology exchanges are expanding in different fields of the economy. I would like to believe that we have outgrown the buy-sell paradigm. We are expected to touch $100 billion in two-way trade, both in goods and services, which is growing in a balanced manner. Our trade and investment linkages have given rise to new foundations of partnerships in innovation, entrepreneurship, high technology, civil nuclear cooperation, food and energy security, employment and wealth creation in both our countries. We are now working on a bilateral investment treaty that would ensure predictability for investors and support economic growth and job creation in both countries. Our militaries, once unfamiliar with each other, now hold regular dialogue and joint exercises. In fact, we do more joint exercises now with the United States than we do with any other country. Our defense trade has increased and we have placed orders worth $8 billion on US equipment manufacturers. The C-130J aircraft that we recently acquired from the US played a visibly important role in the humanitarian relief efforts in Sikkim last year in the wake of the earthquake there. In view of such success stories and the fact that India is continuing the process of modernizing its armed forces, I'm confident that our defense trade will grow even more in the future. Ultimately, the paradigm that we visualize for defense cooperation incorporates a strong component of joint production, research, and co-development, which are all of strategic importance. I'm happy to note that the US government shares this vision. At the same time, we have forged new areas of cooperation, such as renewable energy and energy efficiency, agriculture, higher education, health, and science and technology that are so critical for the socio-economic transformation of India. For instance, we are working together across a full portfolio of clean energy options. The US is assisting us in mapping our reserves of shale gas resources. Through our bilateral science and technology endowment fund of $30 million, we are tapping into our respective scientific and technological strengths and encouraging the co-development of a vibrant S&T ecosystem that could produce material benefits for both our countries as well as produce common global goods. We're partnering with the US across the entire range of issues related to agriculture, from using space technology for better monsoon prediction and crop productivity to improving linkages from farm to market. Health is yet another critical area where there are exciting opportunities for collaboration, tapping into each other's comparative advantages through recent initiatives such as the Global Disease Detection Center, which will facilitate preparedness against health hazards. In view of the importance that both our countries have attached to higher education, we held last year the first India-US Higher Education Summit. The summit underscored the importance of education as a vital pillar of the India-US strategic dialogue and has set forth a compelling roadmap for our joint efforts. Both India and the US have a shared interest in ensuring that the rapid pace of changes in the Asia-Pacific region and the consequent shift in geopolitical and geoeconomic center of gravity to that region promotes overall peace, security, and prosperity. We have therefore strengthened our strategic consultations on developments in the Asia-Pacific and launched a new trilateral dialogue between India, the United States, and Japan, in addition to strengthening our coordination in the East Asia Summit process. Maritime security issues, including anti-piracy, security of sea lanes of communication, ensuring access to the global commons, humanitarian assistance, and disaster relief, are all areas of substantive cooperation between us. We have also launched new dialogues to exchange views and perspectives on developments in Central Asia and in West Asia. These consultations would, in due course, provide the opportunity to identify areas where our two countries can work together. This is just a quick glimpse of the tremendous distance we have covered. Our relationship has been transformed in a dramatic way in a very short time. In this context, I might add that we are also a victim of our own success. While we may all want it is also true, however, that we will not always have big bang initiatives or cut red ribbons at all times. Our multifaceted partnership, covering almost every field of human endeavor, is now on a steady onward course. Our governments are committed to further deepening and expanding the horizons of our partnership and to realize its enormous promise, bringing our two peoples closer and achieving our shared aspirations and goals. Sometimes a few observers tend to mistakenly view this as a, quote, slowdown, unquote, of our relationship. On other occasions, a difference of views on some of the global developments is mistaken as a sign of discord or a reflection of, quote, old habits, unquote, on India's part. This, to my mind, is not only incorrect, but also unhelpful. Such characterization obviously ignores the fact that fundamental reasons have led to transformation of our ties. Our converging security and economic interests, vibrant ties between our peoples, and mutually beneficial connections between our entrepreneurs, as well as our faith in the ideals of democracy, individual liberty, rule of law. In fact, all these remain in place and have actually become more compelling. As I look at the year ahead, I believe that both governments must work with focus to qualitatively improve this relationship. As my friend Ambassador Carl Inderfirth noted recently, we need to consolidate, we need to implement. Our development partnership in education, health, in agriculture, science and technology, and clean energy must be strengthened. Ties between our states should be consciously promoted. Our homeland security dialogue must be further consolidated. Our dialogue on export controls and high technology trade must gather further momentum and show results. On the civil nuclear deal, we need to intensify our efforts in the working group that has been set up to deal with liability issues so as to enable the early activation of the agreement and the participation of U.S. nuclear energy companies in this sector that is so important for our energy security. I hope the discussions on the bilateral investment treaty will also move forward. The upcoming March visit of Commerce Secretary Bryson to India is targeted at enabling realization of commercial opportunities for U.S. companies in the infrastructure space in India, covering roads, railways, airports, and energy. Indian companies are already investing in a growing number of U.S. states, bringing value, creating jobs for Americans, and integrating with local communities. I have no doubt that our strategic dialogue will intensify further, particularly in regard to regional issues and the situation in Asia, and that it will provide an impetus for peace and stability and economic growth. Our External Affairs Minister looks forward to the next strategic dialogue meeting with Secretary Clinton here in Washington this summer. In conclusion, I'd like to say that relations between India and the United States are defined by shared values, convergent interests, the need to bring more progress and prosperity to our peoples, and by the pragmatic realization that we are on the same side when it comes to eliminating those forces that threaten the freedom of our democracies and hinder our development. The fact that this GPS, as it were, identifies our relationship is certainly an encouraging augury for the future. Indeed, it should provide a beacon for our future efforts. Thank you.
Thank you, Ambassador Rao has given us a sweeping overview of India's external relations, especially as it relates to making progress on Indo-US relations. And she has kindly agreed to stay for another 10 minutes or so to take some questions. And what I would ask is, let me see a show of hands and I will call on you and maybe take all the questions at once so that we don't get to take too much time one-on-one. And when you ask the question, please say who you are and where you're from. Okay? Yes. We have a mic that's coming up.
Thank you. I'm Jonathan Roeder from Congressional Quarterly. Ms. Ambassador, as you probably know, on Capitol Hill, there's increasing frustration with Pakistan and our alliance with Pakistan. And there are some lawmakers who are recommending that we cut our ties with Pakistan, and they use the word tilt toward India. And they would be looking forward to India playing the role of the status quo power in Afghanistan after the United States troops leave in 2014. I'd like to get your thoughts on that idea. Thank you.
Yes, next. Stay over here for a second.
Thank you. My name is Jean Ling, with Voice of Vietnamese Americans. Thank you, Madam Ambassador. I would like to ask your opinion and Indian's position about the South China Sea, the TPP, and especially the Indo-Chinese countries, including Myanmar, Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, and Vietnam. We do hope, small question, right? we do hope that our cultural traditional ties, dating 1,000 years back, would help. And we thank you very much for India to step up in that region. I hope to hear from you. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you very much. I'm Bill Gordon from India Global Asia Today. Madam Ambassador, great overview of India-US relations. My quick question is that Ambassador Grossman was recently in India talking about India's role in Afghanistan and India-US relations. My quick question, Madam Ambassador, what role do you think India will or must play in Afghanistan? Because also there is a problem, a neighbor Pakistan does not want India to play any role in Afghanistan. Thank you.
Others? Okay, let me just go to that side since over there.
This is Lalit Shah from Press Trust of India. Can you give us a sense of the talks you are having within the United States on the issue of Iran? U.S. is asking you to reduce India's dependence on Iran and oil, but yes, you can't do that. Thank you.
Okay, I think you've got about one more question first. Actually, we have a student. Let's take a question from a student. Sometimes we overlook the students, even though they're there.
Hello, my name is Andrea Ruiz. Thank you very much for coming and speaking to us today. My question is if you can please speak to the different partnerships or different progress that the view that you representing your country have towards the conservation and preservation of different natural resources with a look at very long-term sustainability. Thank you.
That's a wonderful speech. Thank you, those were all very interesting questions. Talking about the question you raised about the frustration with Pakistan on Capitol Hill, and I get a sense of that, of course. I do visit at Capitol Hill quite frequently. And I think, you know, what we've seen in recent years is a strengthening and deepening of the partnership between India and the United States. And this has involved quite naturally and as part of, you know, the whole process, the deepening of our dialogue when it comes to the situation in our region, particularly events in Afghanistan. And I think the whole issue of terror sanctuaries and the operation of of terror groups with transnational, you know, operability has become very much a part of this dialogue and this discussion. And today, with the Homeland Security Dialogue being initiated between India and the United States and that process moving forward, I think there is much greater clarity of perception from each side about what the nature of this threat is and how we need to work towards its elimination. So, one, of course, you in Washington do, of course, realize, I'm sure, that Pakistan is our neighbor, our immediate neighbor. It's a neighbor with which we've had a difficult, complicated, and very fractious relationship for over six decades now. We are engaged in a very conscious effort, a sincere, honest effort, to try and see how we can reduce the trust deficit in our relations with Pakistan in order to see how we can move towards a coherent process of normalization. Now, this is not going to be easy. There is a lot of difficult terrain ahead. We recognize that. We're realists about it. But the fact is that people on both sides, there is need for trade and business ties to grow. There is a need for travel between the two countries to be made, to be facilitated in a smoother way. In the region of Jammu and Kashmir, we have consciously worked on putting in place confidence-building measures that enable trade across the line of control, better transportation facilities so that people can connect more easily. But fundamentally, I think we have sought to stress and emphasize to Pakistan that there is need for them to act on the issue of terror. It threatens to destroy the fabric of life in Pakistan itself today. I think they realize that very well. So India, I think, as the United States sees it, and I think it's the right way to perceive India, India has stood as an anchor of stability in this region. And India, basically, as I said, wants to turn the geography in the subcontinent into a geography of hope. We want to be able to integrate economically, allow the benefits of our development and the accelerated development that we've been seeing in India to benefit our neighbors also. And that has been the approach that we've taken with Sri Lanka when we signed the first free trade agreement that we ever signed with any country more than a decade ago, our relations with Bangladesh, the very special relationship that we have with Nepal and with Bhutan, and the opening to Pakistan now. But Afghanistan and what happens there is really of concern to us, and that goes on to the question that was asked to me about Mr. Grossman's visit. What is the role that we seek to play in Afghanistan? Well, our vision of Afghanistan, that it should become a stable, peaceful, very strongly democratic country. It's a very diverse society. It's a plural society, very much like India's. How do you cohere all the different ethnic groups and interests in Afghanistan together? That is the challenge. And now with the dialogue that has been launched with the Taliban, we'll have to see where that goes. But our vision for Afghanistan is that the progress that has been made in the last decade and a little more than that should not be turned back. And the benefits that have accrued to women and children particularly should not be diminished in any way. Afghanistan, and very few people perhaps recall this, but the modernization of Afghan society in the early 20th century came really out of the impetus that was provided by Indian Muslims, educated Indian Muslims, who had this vision of an independent region working together. And the converse of that has happened now with the Taliban coming out of Pakistan, trying to radicalize and extremize, and make the place much more extreme. So hopefully we can all work together to ensure that the gains of Afghan progress are not set back in any way, and that whatever dispensation emerges in Afghanistan will promote peace and stability within that country, enable it to be a hub of trade and economic connectivity with the rest of the region, because Afghanistan is designed to be that in many senses, a kind of pivot for South Asia. On India's position on the South China Sea, well, the South China Sea is a very vital waterway. Much of world and global and regional maritime trade goes through the South China Sea. So obviously we would like to see it dispute-free. We would like to see disputes that exist in the area to be resolved peacefully. We are not taking sides. It's not that we are advocating one case against the other. It is obviously for the country's concern. And I know that Vietnam and China are now engaged in discussions to see what they can do about the Paracel and Spratly Islands. So this process, we hope, and within the ASEAN and the East Asia, the ASEAN plus three process also, I know that there are efforts being made to see how you can introduce some kind of a code of conduct and an approach that would build more convergence and reduce differences, and as the Chinese say, build common ground. But obviously the attention of the region is very much focused on this area, and we would not like to see tensions build up. We would like whatever security architecture that is put in place to be inclusive. I don't believe the answer lies in isolating China. We have to draw China into a consultative process. We have to be able to impress upon China the need for more transparency and more dialogue and better communication. So I think that is the challenge before all of us, and we have to work together to ensure that. China is one of our, it is our largest neighbor. It's an enormously important relationship for India, and we have sought very assiduously and very consciously to improve relations with China, even though there are outstanding issues, particularly the boundary question between the two countries, that needs to be resolved. But we have made some progress in that regard. We are seeking again to reduce differences. We have maintained peace and tranquility on our borders. We have mechanisms in place that enable us to contact each other, each side the other, whenever there is any incipient tension. So I think that kind of a management regime, as it were, for the relationship is extremely important. China is going through a period of political transition this year, and this is an important year in many senses because we have elections in many, many important countries. So the challenge before all of us, in Vietnam and China being very much our stakeholders in what happens in our region, we have to work together and in a very mature and very far-seeing manner to make sure that whatever we are able to achieve consolidates the progress of the last few years and does not take away from it. And that goes for trade and economic relations also. The ASEAN and India Free Trade Agreement, as you know, has been launched, and now we're looking at a similar free trade agreement in services. And with a number of countries in ASEAN, we have very, very solid trade relations. And you know, India is a country that borders Southeast Asia. If you look at Burma, Myanmar, India and Myanmar share a common border. And I often see, and Mr. Manishankar Iyer, who's here, you know, has often said this too, that Southeast Asia begins in Northeast India. So in many senses, India is a multi-regional country. It's not just South Asian, but it has an eastward perspective also. And that forms very much a part of our Look East policy to Southeast Asia and to East Asia. Talking of Iran, a question from Lalit. Well, we are in touch with the U.S. government and, of course, closely monitoring the developing situation concerning Iran. Iran is an important source for our crude petroleum imports. These imports have declined a little, not very much, but a little over the last couple of years, last 2 years or so. And we'll have to see. I mean, given the sanctions and given the difficulties in operating banking channels vis-a-vis Iran, obviously, you know, the volume cannot be expected to go up in such a situation. It may well be that there may be a further decline. It may well be so. India is a responsible country. India works with the rest of the international community we abide by the rules. Obviously, we don't play outside the system on these issues. But it must be remembered that the Gulf region is terribly important for India. We have 6 million Indians working there. Their remittances come home to their families here. They're important for our economy. It's a source of our energy imports. India is basically an energy importing country. So look at the Mangalore refinery, for instance. It is geared just to work with Iranian crude, about 110,000 barrels a day or so. So it's going to take time to readjust and to see how we can move away from the old patterns of how we operate on these issues. But we certainly hope there will, you know, we're not for confrontation, we're not for military confrontation, we would not like to see the situation escalate to a point of no return. And I think the avenues of diplomacy and statecraft have not been exhausted. I think definitely Iran has to hear, you know, the voice of the international community clearly on this issue. Things should not come to a pass where, you know, it becomes very difficult to retract positions. And as far as Iran's nuclear program is concerned, we've said very, very clearly that we do not want Iran to weaponize. We don't want Iran to go down that path at all. As an NPT member, it has certain rights to develop its nuclear energy for peaceful purposes, but it has to work with the International Atomic Energy Agency and the rest of the international community to assuage the concerns that have been raised so that, you know, we can then move forward, hopefully, to a situation where the tensions are eased. And on the conservation of and preservation of natural resources, obviously, a country of India's size with a 1.2 billion population with energy shortages obviously, you know, is looking very much to see how we can look at non-conventional energy resources, renewable energy, clean energy, which I mentioned in my speech earlier, is what we're talking to partners like the United States, and also consciously through research and innovation within the country, through the kind of mission mode projects that we have launched under the direction of the Prime Minister, to see how we can utilize these sources of energy. And so, you know, you must understand, I don't know if you've been to India. Have you been to India? No, you have to be to India to understand the complexity and the enormity of the challenges we face. This is not a textbook situation, you know, where you can say this has to be done, you should conserve this, and you should save on this, and you should work like this on climate change. Please go to India and understand the plight of the common man and his or her need for development. The fact that 500 million people in the country don't have electricity, you know, we have to build roads, we have to improve our airports, we have to modernize our railways, we have to generate much more electricity, we have to educate hundreds and millions of children, you know, who are coming into our schools, improve our higher university education. So it's a whole different scene from what you may be normally accustomed to. So I invite you first to come to India and understand it. Thank you.
I think Ambassador Rao has treated us to a very wide menu of issues between India and US and generally. She mentioned Prime Minister Singh's quote that there are no irritants whatsoever between India and the US. I somehow think that as we look ahead, we'll still need a very skillful diplomat to handle whatever is in store. And I'm happy to say I think that the Indo-US relationship is in good hands. So please join me in thanking Ambassador Rao for taking time.
Thank you so much.